Hello, and welcome to the Scope of Things podcast, a no-nonsense look at the promise and problems of clinical research based on a sweep of the latest news and emerging trends in the field, and what I think is worthy of your 30 or so minutes of time. I'm Deborah Borfitz, Senior Science Writer for Clinical Research News, which means I spend a lot of time with my ear to the ground on your behalf, and a lot of hours every week speaking to top experts from around the world. Please consider making this your trusted go-to channel for staying current on things that matter, whether they give us hope or cause for pause. In another 10 minutes or so, I'll be speaking with Dr. Donna Murphy, Chief Scientific Officer for Lifelines Neuro, about shortcomings in the way EEGs are being used in clinical trials to monitor participants for potential brain damage. But first, I'm going to give my monthly rundown on some of the late-breaking news and emerging trends that have caught my attention, including the launch of a company using single-solution software to connect a global network of clinical trial sites to study sponsors, a Pharmacy First program that is launched in the UK, the development of an international real-world cohort that could help eliminate the need for traditional trials for kids with rare conditions, a centralized staffing initiative of the National Cancer Institute, a new community-based respiratory virus study involving a rapid at-home multi-pathogen test, the current precision oncology clinical trial landscape, a pioneering translational research program in Spain promoting collaboration between fundamental scientists and practicing physicians, and progress in getting patient-derived organoids into clinical trials to evaluate drug response. Former deputy director of the FDA's Oncology Center of Excellence has just launched Pi Health, an oncology-focused research company that aims to overhaul the drug approval process and help bring modern and equitable trials to populations worldwide. Currently, less than 8% of eligible cancer patients participate in clinical studies. The focus is on the collection of the type and quality of data required by the agency by integrating a single solution platform into a network of clinical trial sites in the US, Brazil, Australia, and India that connects them to life science sponsors. The software incorporates generative AI and features such as automation of clinical documentation, patient matching, data transformations, and adverse event monitoring. Pi Health has also opened a state-of-the-art hospital in India. The announcement, which I'll link to in the show notes, coincides with the raising of over $30 million in Series A funding. News outlets around the UK have reported that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak launched a new Pharmacy First program to deal with the notoriously long wait times for care by the National Health Service. People there will now be able to receive care for seven common conditions, such as sinusitis, sore throat, and middle ear infections by seeing a pharmacist at one of more than 10,000 retail locations in England, including Boots, part of global pharmacy leader Walgreens Boots Alliance. The move is expected to free up around 10 million appointments with general practitioners each year. In the U.S., pharmacies like Walgreens are expanding pharmacy services to address longstanding challenges in healthcare, providing convenient, high-value care and improve access to innovative treatments. So, what does this have to do with clinical trials? Possibly quite a lot if Walgreens has its way. Walgreens launched its real-world evidence clinical trials business less than 2 years ago to make clinical trials more accessible, convenient, and equitable for the 78% of Americans who live within 5 miles of Walgreens. Since then, the company has partnered with life science companies to reach over 2 million Americans about participating in a clinical trial. Nearly half of patients enrolling in Walgreens managed trials come from historically underserved populations. I'll include links in the show notes providing more information about both the Pharmacy First program and the clinical trials business of Walgreens. In a first for pediatric research, scientists at the Hospital for Sick Children in Canada overcame one of the key barriers of conducting randomized controlled trials in children with rare diseases, that is, the limited number of kids with any one condition and ethical concerns about the use of placebo controls, by using data from an international real-world cohort. Their statistical approach mimics clinical trial results by comparing present-day outcomes to historical data, and it could eliminate the need for traditional trials, as investigators demonstrated in a study looking at the effectiveness of a medication for kids with a genetic disorder affecting the liver. Similar methods could theoretically be applied to any rare disease given enough historical data on individuals with a specific rare disease. I'll link to the study in the show notes once again. In the U.S., the National Cancer Institute recently announced that it has a new initiative underway to address dwindling patient enrollment with centralized staffing support. The new virtual clinical trials office is meant to address a staffing shortage exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic that has disproportionately affected rural and underserved areas. The support has opened several NCI clinical trials networks and can include eligibility screening, patient enrollment and education, and data entry. 6 cancer centers around the U.S. are participating in the initial phase of the pilot program. The City University of New York reports that it is collaborating with Pfizer on a 2-year community-based cohort study to track the short and long-term effects of multiple respiratory viruses, specifically COVID-19, RSV, and flu types A and B. The new Project Protects, as it's called, builds on the Chasing COVID cohort study ongoing since March 2020 that has been monitoring SARS-CoV-2 infection rates and associated risk factors through questionnaires and at-home serological testing. The project will harness both PCR assays and a new at-home multi-pathogen rapid test to investigate the incidence and symptoms severity of the various respiratory viruses. Up to 6,000 participants will be enrolled across the U.S., and study finding could shape future public health strategies and interventions to mitigate the impact of severe respiratory viruses on population health outcomes. Kudos to Pfizer for staying in front of these widespread triple threat respiratory illnesses that have become harder to manage and advanced testing options that accommodate the busy everyday lives of people. Contract research organization Novotech publishes multiple free reports and white papers every year, and the latest one on the precision oncology clinical trial landscape indicates that in over 10,000 trials initiated between 2019 and 2023, 30% focused on targeted therapies. In terms of where that research is taking place, the Asia-Pacific region takes the lead with a 39% share of the trials and stands out for its efficiency with the shortest median enrollment period and the highest recruitment rate. The rise of personalized medicine has led to greater adoption of adaptive, basket, and umbrella trials that accelerate drug development and reduce costs while allowing for more targeted patient grouping based on biomarkers. In fact, over 60% of cancer drugs authorized by regulatory agencies now carry pharmacogenomic labels that reflect a significant increase in clinically actionable biomarkers, Novotech reports. As of November 2023, the FDA has approved 12 treatments for unique biomarker-selected indications, and over the past year, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines have incorporated 6 biomarker and indication-specific treatments. There's still plenty of opportunity for potential druggable targets in precision oncology, given that 1/3 of human proteins are unstudied and only 3% are targeted by approved drugs. The caveats here are that small molecule treatments account for 60% of FDA-approved drugs, but benefit only 7-8% of cancer patients. As cancer patients well know, accessing precision oncology studies can also be difficult because only a relatively small network of centers offers them, and referral systems aren't particularly well developed. IRB Barcelona has announced the launch of a pioneering translational research innovation program in a trio of laboratories in the region to promote collaboration between fundamental scientists and physicians who combine research with clinical practice. Their focus areas, respectively, are metastatic breast cancer, a new approach for treating gastrointestinal tract sarcomas, and metastasis metabolism. The program will define joint research projects between scientists at IRB Barcelona and physician scientists at hospitals in Catalonia. And the integration is expected to foster development of new diagnostic and therapeutic tools or improve existing ones and potentially lead to the establishment of biotechnology companies and product licensing. New laboratories are also to be started that will focus on emerging strategic fields such as immunology, inflammation and its relation to cancer and aging, and epigenomics and cell lineage tracing. Finally, patient-derived organoids that serve as miniature models of individuals' cancerous tumors are now being used in a handful of clinical trials to help evaluate which cancer treatments might work before administering them to patients. To help vet the experimental variables, scientists at the Salk Institute took a close look at these ones being used as a clinical model of pancreatic cancer. They found one commercially available extracellular matrix used in the cell culture, it's called Matrigel, increased the growth rate of the organoids to make them particularly well-suited for the fast pace of pancreatic cancer treatment protocols. Although using either of the two other brands didn't change the clinical call for any patient, the experiments took 20 to 40% longer. And in pancreatic cancer, the researchers note, timing is everything. I'll link to their study in the show notes. Okay, I'd now like to bring to the mic today's guest, Dr. Donna Murphy, Chief Scientific Officer for Lifelines Neuro, who was on a grassroots crusade with study sponsors and CROs to inform their decision-making about when and how to include brain monitoring data in their clinical studies. Welcome to the show, Dr. Murphy.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, to get us started, can you provide a picture of how EEG monitoring, right or wrong, is being used in clinical trials today in terms of the therapeutic areas where brain monitoring is employed and for which types of patients and study phases, as well as who is doing these tests and reading the results? Give us the big picture here.
Sure. Brain monitoring is being used principally in CNS or central nervous system drug development. And there has been renewed interest in CNS drug development in the last 10, 15 years. It's used in all phases, one, two, three, four. It's used preclinically in animals also. So prior to first in human trials as well. Sometimes it is being used in other kinds of drug development where there is indication in preclinical trials that a drug has the propensity to cause seizures in animals. Sometimes when there is strong theoretical concern that a drug as a function of its mechanism of action can cause seizures, there will be an interest in doing safety, what we call safety EEG, especially in first in human trials. There also is, I think, strong and growing interest in using EEG as a biomarker. And that can be as a prognostic or predictive biomarker. There is not great evidence that EEG can be used in this way. It's more kind of an exploratory endpoint. I think there's a lot of excitement about this, especially as we're able to employ things like machine learning, artificial intelligence, but it is still very much exploratory.
Got it. And who's doing these tests and reading the results of these tests as a rule? Or is it just one particular type of expert?
Yes. So the people who can read qualitative EEGs or EEGs in safety purposes, those would be the clinical experts, neurologists who are trained in reading EEG. They would be either clinical neurophysiologists or people specialized in epilepsy.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Now let's toggle to the ideal scenario for how EEG monitoring should be used in clinical research. How would it go and under what circumstances if trials were all under your watch?
Sure. So I think, first of all, we should take from the guidelines that are provided by professional organizations or societies like the American Clinical Neurophysiology Society or ACNS. IPEG, which is the society that defines how we can use quantitative EEG in clinical trials specifically, that also provides us a framework that will allow us to standardize our practices around quantitative EEG in clinical trials. I think most people do these things, particularly for safety EEG. I think they are implementing at the very least the clinical standards for acquiring that data. What is unclear, I will say from my anecdotal experience, seems to be very all over the map in terms of what sponsors and CROs are doing for at least safety EEG in clinical trials, is that the amount of data they collect and when they collect that data is very variable with respect to when the person is exposed to the compound. And I think
there is great interest in understanding what happens after exposure, but it's obviously equally as important to understand whether there was some susceptibility to what we call epileptiform discharges, or kind of indicators that there is a risk for that person to have seizures, potentially a baseline, right? So for in first in human trials, you want to be sure that that person doesn't have a susceptibility for that if they're then going to be exposed to a drug that can cause seizures. And you need to collect as much information prior to drug exposure as after drug exposure, because the longer you collect data, the likelier it is that you are going to find something abnormal. So for the drug sponsor's sake, it's important to know if that person actually did have a susceptibility, that, you know, that might have been the reason for them having a seizure or having epileptiform discharges after drug exposure, and not the drug itself. So in terms of de-risking, it's important for the sponsor, it's important for the subject to know that everything is being done to ensure their safety, right? So we want to make sure that we're collecting enough information in terms of, you know, does this drug exposure cause them to have epileptiform discharges or frank seizures? That's important for the subject and also for future patients who may be exposed to the drug or who may be prescribed the drug.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we both know that study sponsors take their lead from regulators. So what does the FDA have to say about all of this?
You know, it's interesting. The FDA weighs in when individual applications come in for drug approvals. And the companies, it's really kind of their prerogative as to whether to submit information prior to hearing from the FDA that they would like to know actually what the result of an EEG study is. The sponsors often themselves, I will say that when they do see in preclinical studies that animals are having seizures, often at high doses of the medications, obviously if they're having seizures at low doses of the medications, that is the end of the drug development for that particular compound. But it's often the case that if seizures are seen, they're seeing them at very high doses, doses that they don't expect to have to give the equivalents of in humans. And so they're worried then, I think legitimately, that even at lower doses, potentially they may see something in humans, right? They still may cause seizures in humans. They don't know that until they actually do that, that trial. And they will themselves often be motivated because they know that ultimately if that happens, that the FDA will come back to them and say that they need to do these studies. And so they are kind of preemptively searching for vendors to actually do this work with them so that they can present all of that data to the FDA, you know, without doing that in a reactive way. But the FDA doesn't, unfortunately, provide guidelines for how that needs to be done, whether it needs to be done. And that can be very difficult then for companies to know exactly how to do that work.
Yeah. And guidelines for ECG monitoring came out decades ago now, is it?
Exactly. Right. So those came out in the early 90s. And there was, I think, also then legitimate concern that there were compounds that were causing QT prolongation, which makes people susceptible to cardiac arrhythmias. So there's, you know, it's kind of like analogous in many ways. Right. And that's very dangerous, obviously, and life-threatening, just as seizures can be very dangerous and life-threatening. And now for a long time, we have cardiac monitoring as a standard practice in development of many different kinds of drugs. But we very rarely see EEG being used still.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's lots of reasons for the silence from regulators, as well as, I mean, what's driving also the choices being made by sponsors in the absence of guidance? What's sort of happening out there in terms of, you know, the rationale for decision-making, I guess, around this?
Sure. So, you know, some sponsors I can tell through the consultation work that I've done that they're really seeking for someone to tell them that it's okay not to incorporate EEG in their studies. And, you know, honestly, if they see seizures or if there is strong theoretical risk for seizures, you know, if they see seizures in animals, I think at whatever dose, it's really critical to do that in first in human trials, to do the EEG study, to just kind of convince ourselves that this is not harming people, at least acutely, right? Where we don't immediately see epileptiform discharges in the brain or seizures happening. They unfortunately don't know, you know, how much data to collect before and after, and they're often kind of motivated by how complex it is logistically, how expensive it is. that often is driving their decision making around how to implement this. I will say, like, also on the reading side of this, in terms of reading those studies, reading that, interpreting that data that comes in, often they're making the choice to go with a single expert reader, which is really very inappropriate in many ways. In academia, when we publish papers that submit EEG as data, right, to make the argument in the paper, those EEGs are being reviewed by at least two people where there is consensus or there is adjudication. And that's required because we see a lot of inter-reader variability. And this, unfortunately, is not standard practice in clinical trials. So sponsors will say, well, we have a favorite reader. We'd like that reader to be involved in reading all of these studies alone themselves. And, you know, again, that can be both dangerous for the patient. It can, you know, not be helpful in de-risking the clinical trial, and it's not scientifically sound.
Yeah. I have to understand, why push for this only now? I started reading about EEG, so I didn't know much about it coming in. They were first used in the 1920s. What has changed to add urgency to the situation?
Yeah, I think because there is renewed interest in CNS drug development. And, I think in that way, greater risk of actually having drugs that are meant to penetrate the brain that can potentially result in long-term damage to the brain, specifically through this mechanism of causing epileptiform discharges or seizures. It's important to look at that. There are a lot of other compounds that are also seen to, of other drug classes that are also seen to cause epileptiform discharges and seizures. I remember as a resident that we were often concerned about people who had kind of altered consciousness in the ICU and they were on a bunch of different antibacterial medications. Those things can also, some classes of those medications can cause you to have seizures. So, you know, we need to be, I think, more vigilant about this. In CNS drug development specifically, right, neuro and psych drug development, we see a lot of interest in psychedelics lately. Those, you know, we know at least with some of this kind of street psychedelics, there is actually, or hallucinogens, there is an increased risk of seizures. I'm not sure exactly how mindful these sponsors are of that potential risk. So far have not seen, at least from the request for proposals that we get at Lifelines, a ton of companies coming for us to do safety EEG and psychedelic drug development. These are the areas where I think because they've become of increasing interest to sponsors and they're doing these drug trials, we should also, you know, in parallel, be thinking about what we can do to keep these subjects in the research and then also ultimately the patients the safest.
Yes. How do you imagine we're going to right this ship? Do you have any formal or informal collaborators in your quest to bring about the needed change? How are you going to make this happen?
Yes. You know, so over time, I think in doing this work, I have connected with academics who, you know, understand how different this can be than, you know, the standards that we have in a peer-reviewed publication, for instance. I have worked with sponsors also themselves where we have a lot of questions that are just, we have no guidance, right? And so we're trying to figure out what makes the most sense, what would keep the patient safest, again, what would be best for de-risking the trial for them. Also working with colleagues in preclinical EEG and thinking about how we translate those results into first in human subjects EEG. All of these folks, I think collectively, we know that there is a need for more guidance on this, more standardization of our practices. I think many of us have put things out there in terms of external communications or public engagement. We are working on a paper together, actually that a peer-reviewed paper together that will hopefully encourage other people in the industry to take notice. But it is very much a grassroots fight. I have tried to reach out to the FDA, to a number of people there to see if whether they can get involved in setting these guidelines. I'm not really sure historically how it came about that the QT prolongation guidelines were put in place. But it's been very challenging going that direction, kind of top down.
Yeah. Is there any way to address sort of the cost question that I'm sure keeps coming up as sponsors that they have to deal with, sort of dealing with what it's going to cost to implement all the things to keep patients safe? I mean, you got to have a balance between the two at some level.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like, we can't, for instance, keep people on EEG monitoring for 40 years, right? And, you know, there is also this theoretical possibility that, you know, maybe you don't see something acutely, but something evolves over, kind of more of a chronic timeline. But that's not practical, obviously. Mm. So I do think that, what we have to be mindful of here is kind of the risk to the lives of human beings and the cost of that, right? Like, that certainly has happened before, like in recent history, that somebody actually in a study where they were doing EEG monitoring, somebody died in that trial. Mm-hmm. And it was as a function of damage to the brain. And so I think it is really important to think about that potential outcome that will kill a drug in development, right? And it will obviously take the lives of the people involved. And that is a tremendous cost. So I think kind of weighing that with like the cost of actually doing the studies, which are not inexpensive, right? Like, there are hundreds to thousands of dollars depending on the length and complexity of the study that we're being asked to do, per study. It's not inexpensive. At the same time, you know, it's not inexpensive to do serial MRI brain monitoring. And we've incorporated that into the latest, you know, Alzheimer's medications. So I don't think it's impossible to do.
Yeah.
Any
final predictions about when and if change will happen before we conclude for the day here?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think that the important thing is like the process, I think, of engagement, like the education, you know, getting more and more people on board, which is, I think, what we're trying to do here with this podcast. I can't tell you when it's going to ultimately happen that we have standard practice around this, but we're going to keep trying.
Okay. Well, we'll take that as a positive, optimistic final thought. It will obviously be quite a paradigm shift, no matter how we look at it, Dr. Murphy, but you sound well equipped for the job and with the passion for patients I'd expect from an MD. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy day to share some of what you know about de-risking trials for study sponsors and participants in particular, while we await the voice of regulators to drive these points home.
Thank you so much.
As always, a big thank you to everyone out there for listening in. If you're not subscribed to this podcast yet, please consider going to Apple Podcasts and doing so right now so you don't miss your monthly dose of news and perspectives you'll be hard-pressed to find anywhere else. And if you're up for it, I'd also be so very grateful if you'd leave a rating and review while you're there. For more straight talk on studies involving humans, visit clinicalresearchnewsonline.com. And if you are a clinical research professional, we hope also to see you at our next SCOPE conference, where we make things happen. Bye for now.